years in solitary confinement. Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. In this edition of Radio Curious, we visit with Stephen Sifra, a 38-year-old undergraduate student at the University of California at Berkeley, who spent almost 16 years in prison, beginning when he was 14 years old. Having been held in the solitary confinement security housing units of California's juvenile and adult prisons for almost 8 years, he recently participated in the California prisoners' hunger strikes in solidarity with the prisoners to end the use of the solitary confinement facilities. In this, the first of a two-part series on prisons from the prisoner's perspective, Stephen Sifra shares his story and experiences. In part two, we talk about his reflections and how he chose to turn his life around. Our conversation, recorded from his home in Berkeley, California, on September 14, 2013, began when I asked him what led up to his first incarceration.
I was incarcerated continuously with probably 4 month break from the time I was 14 until I was 30. And then a little bit before that, about a year or two before that, doing juvenile hall time and a couple month-long violations, several month-long violations after. But between that time, pretty much continuously incarcerated in the California Youth Authority and the California Department of Corrections here in California. And, what kind of facilities? I mean, high security juvenile facilities to low security adult facilities all the way through level four, which is the highest level security, and then the security housing unit, which I was in for 8 years.
Of those experiences, what had the most effect on you? Looking back,
I think what had the most lasting effect on me was my time in isolation. When I was in level four, it was the most terrifying. But when I was in isolation, it was a different kind of terror. It wasn't the very acute, you're in danger right now terror, but it was the more subtle and lasting terror of just being alone and being alone with my thoughts for 8 years.
When you say being alone, absolute solitary all the time for 8 years, were there breaks?
Yeah, so I was in solitary confinement for 4 years between the ages of 16 and 21. And then I was, again, 4 years between the ages of 23 and 27.
Why were you put there?
For the first time, it was because I was a pain in the ass, basically.
What does that mean?
Okay, so when I was in California Youth Authority, they put me in a program, substance abuse program, and I was just non-compliant. I didn't want to do their homework assignments, and I was basically I was just an unruly kid. And they didn't want to have to deal with unruly kids, so a fight broke out in which I was attacked by another inmate. But they said that I incited this, large-scale racial conflict by being punched by this guy, and they sent me to isolation. During the investigation, they ruled, okay, Stephen Sifra caused this by standing in this other guy's spot in line, which incited the guy to punch him, which incited the melee. So they labeled me the ringleader, and believe me, I'm nobody's ringleader. I didn't have very many leadership qualities at the time. So It was just an excuse to get rid of me, just for being non-compliant.
So you were in a juvenile facility in solitary confinement again for how long?
4 years.
And what was the reason that you were sent to juvenile prison?
Carjacking.
Yeah, that means car theft?
Uh-huh. So I was in California's authority for carjacking, which is an armed robbery. You rob somebody of their vehicle. It was quite sensational at the time, actually. There was a big carjacking hysteria, and so I don't know if you remember that back in the 90s, but I was a part of that.
What brought you to do that? In other words, what was your home life or your family life like?
It was typical, for relatively speaking. And I mean, like, relative to the community I was brought up in, there was, you know, my mother was a hardcore alcoholic. So she would open the bar and close the bar literally every day. She would go, she would wake up pretty much before we got up and, you know, go to the bar where she worked, and she would open it and conduct business there all day and drink there all day. And, you know, she would close it at 2 o'clock in the morning and come home, and, you know, we'd be asleep. So, ostensibly, I mean, that wasn't always the case. Sometimes we wouldn't even be home. And so we were just really, we had the opportunity to do whatever we wanted. And before this happened, when my, you know, the early days of my family life, it was really just my dad and my mom duking it out. Really, my dad beating my mom up until my mom was able to leave. By the time I was around 5, my mom left. So when she took us with her, after a couple of years, she took us with her, and there was, my dad wasn't there to beat us up anymore. And so, and my mom wasn't there to curb my behavior either. So really was, I went from this really intense, violent, disciplinary setting to no discipline at all. And it was just a free-for-all after that. Living in downtown L.A., you know, crime-ridden neighborhood, no food in the house, no clothes, no furniture, just that whole, I mean, you can just imagine. I mean, the communities like that, they're all over. And so, yeah, that's the community I grew up in. That's the household I grew up in.
So looking back on that period of your life up until you were 14, and were first incarcerated, what was your education like?
Well, I dropped out of school in the fifth grade. I stopped going pretty much in the fourth grade. I would ditch school once I realized that, well, I knew I didn't like school because it was, you know, people telling me what to do, and I wasn't used to that at that point. So when I realized that I could really just stop going and there wasn't going to be any consequence, I did that. So I stopped going in the fourth grade. About halfway through, I really stopped altogether. And then by the fifth grade, I wasn't going at all. And I was just, I would get dropped off at school. And at a certain point, there would be an LAPD officer standing out and or parking his car in front of my school just to make sure I went in. Officer Gephardt from the Hollywood division would be posted up in his black and white in front of my school, and he'd watch me go in, he'd drive off, and then I would jump over the fence in the back, and that really didn't last too long. After not too long, they got us in a L.A. County probation boardroom and told my whole family that if I didn't start going to school, they were going to send us all to foster homes and break up the family. And then a detective from the LAPD actually got me in a room by myself and told me, if you don't start going to school, we are going to put you in Central Juvenile Hall where you're going to be raped by large inmates. And it still wasn't enough to compel me to go to school. So, I mean, just I didn't have the ability to do nearly anything that was asked of me. I mean, it was, I don't know. It was pretty scary, actually, towards the end. I didn't know what was going to happen, but I knew I didn't have the ability to do what they wanted me to do, no matter how much I wanted to do that. So,
Well, Stephen Sifra, I want to ask you about the time in solitary confinement and go back to what you mentioned earlier, its effect on you. But before we go there, I want to say that in this edition of Radio Curious, we're talking with Stephen Sifra, a 38-year-old man who is now a student at the University of California at Berkeley, who in his earlier life spent over a period of two different times, a total of 8 years in solitary confinement in the California juvenile and adult prisons. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Stephen, during the time that you were in solitary confinement, what was it like?
Okay, so I was in solitary confinement for 8 years. The first 4 years were as a juvenile. The conditions of that solitary confinement, were atrocious. They were like the kinds of images you might conjure when you hear that term, solitary confinement. That was the conditions, you know, alone, in a room, covered up a lot of the time, nothing in the cell, maybe a book if I was lucky, not coming out. You know, there's this idea or this kind of program where you're in your cell for 23 hours a day and you come out for an hour a day. That wasn't the case in the California authority. You know, we would go months without leaving our cell. I actually went a full year without ever leaving my cell other than being brought out to give, you know, bathe every other day. You know, they would open my door, handcuff me, take me to the shower for 3 minutes, and then put me back in my cell. That went on for a year. We didn't even know about any law that said we were allowed to come out for an hour a day. So that was the first half. The second half, by the time I became an adult and went to the security housing unit where I was at for 4 years, you know, they put me in a cell by myself, and they gave me some books. Well, actually, they didn't give me books. They let me have the books that I had acquired for myself. And after a couple years, my brother sent me a black and white television. Those conditions were, by the time I got there, I was like, this is actually not that bad. Now that I look back on it, to have that model or that idea like, oh, I'm here, I am alone with, you know, 10 books and a black and white television, and this is kind of nice, speaks to something. I don't know what, human condition, resiliency, or just how terrible the whole solitary confinement in our state is.
What were your days like?
Well, I got to the point where I could care for myself. I could care for my emotional needs, and I could care for my physical and my spiritual needs.
How did you do that?
Any number of ways. It would change for a while. For a few years, I would draw. For, you know, once I realized that my next door neighbor would yell through the vent, and he would give me tips on how to draw, and I realized, hey, I can do this. So for about several years, I would just draw all day, and it was like something that I could do that was meaningful and gratifying. It wasn't just me sitting in a box.
Stephen, what kinds of things did you draw?
My favorites were portraits. So my first drawing was a portrait of my nephew that I sent to my mother. And when I got out, you know, many years later, and I saw it hanging on her wall, it was the worst. It was the worst thing I'd ever seen. But at the time, it was a victory. You know, I was like, yes, I can do this. You know, it was just so thrilling. It was like almost like a small parole, knowing that, you know, my days of whiling away the hours were over. I now had something I could do. And
you had pictures or things that you could reproduce with pencil and paper.
Primarily I drew for other people. I didn't have much of a relationship with my family, so I would get a couple letters from them, and my sister would send me pictures of my nephews. She had a couple sons, but mostly I would draw for other people. So, you know, somebody down the way said, hey, man, you know, can you draw me, you know, a little card for my, you know, son? His birthday's coming up. You know, I'd, find something in a magazine, maybe a little picture of Mickey Mouse or something.
Now, this was when you were in juvenile solitary confinement or adult?
It was adult, yeah. It was when I was an adult.
Why were you sent to adult solitary confinement?
I was about to parole. I was about less than a week away from paroling. I had finished my 3-year prison term, and I was standing in line waiting for the cooks to make more pancakes because they always ran out of pancakes on pancake day. And, you know, it was just one of those things where, you know, it was a stare-off, a face-off between me and another inmate. And, you know, I was like, what are you looking at? He's like, what are you looking at? And we got in a fight. And because he was black and I was white, the authorities threw the book at me. You know, they said it was, you know, I was trying to instigate a race, you know, a race confrontation, like a group confrontation, like a riot. And I was just like, no, it was just one of those things, man. We just got in a fist fight, but they didn't want to hear anything about it, even though I'd been a model inmate up to that point. And, you know, I was paroling. I was a teacher's assistant for 3 years. I taught inmates how to, you know, run an office, do office duties. And they didn't care. They just threw the book at me. They gave me a 9-month SHU term, which is a term in solitary confinement. Well, the next day, an officer was taunting me. He, you know, they pulled me out of my cell in handcuffs, and he was standing in front of me taunting me, and I spit on him. And, oh, man, they lost it. They gave me, several more years in the security housing unit. They gave me another felony charge, tried to give me a 25-to-life sentence for that. And, so I ended up doing 4 years in solitary.
So there were two things there when the officer was taunting you and you spit on him. One was putting you in solitary confinement, and was the other a criminal trial in the Superior Court of that county?
Yes, when I spit on the officer, exactly. They charged me with assault and battery, and because I had prior felony convictions, they charged me with 3 strikes. So they sent me back to court with a 3 strikes charge, meaning if convicted, I would get 25 to life.
What county was that?
Fresno.
And what happened?
So I went to court for a year, pretty much just to get the lunches. I didn't really even care much about the 25 to life charge. After a while, I just kind of got used to the idea, okay, you're going to do life now. It was actually in the offing. Like, it was coming down the pike. I could see it coming. So when it happened, I wasn't terribly surprised. I was disappointed at first, but, you know, I would just go to court. We would drag it out, you know, just hoping something would give. And on the last day, after a year of proceedings, at the trial confirmation, my hanging judge took the day off, and I got a different judge who said, I am not giving this man 25 to life for spitting on somebody. And the DA was like, well, you know, it's a slam dunk case. This guy's he's a bad apple. He's the worst of the worst. We got to get rid of him. And the judge said, I'm not hearing it. Give him an offer. They offered me 6 years, and then after the probation report came through, they realized that the sentencing guidelines only allowed them to either give me 4 years or 25. So they gave me 4 years, and I ended up doing another 4 years in solitary as well as in prison.
The time that you did the 4 years in solitary, that was determined by the Department of Corrections, the prison system, rather than the court, right?
Uh-huh.
Was there any kind of due process or an opportunity for a hearing for you to present your reasons in case why you should not be put in solitary confinement?
Well, there is a due process. There's the 115 process for rules violations. There's another kind of solitary confinement conviction or solitary confinement set of circumstances in which they don't have due process, really, and that's the validated gang associate indeterminate SHU term. Mine was adjudicated at a 115 hearing. So they say, okay, well, you spit on an officer. That means that you lose 365 days of good time, and it also carries a X number of years in solitary confinement. And so in that way, it was very determinate, and I knew exactly how much, you know, solitary I was going to be doing. Like, they like gave me a date. That's like in contrast to the validated security housing unit, the SHU terms.
When you had the hearing, did you have a lawyer?
No, there's no lawyers.
Did you have anyone to speak on your behalf and help you through the process?
No. The process for taking good time and giving people SHU terms is pretty relaxed. The idea or the attitude is basically, you know, your ass belongs to us and we'll do whatever we want with you. So in those terms, it's just like, even if you don't do what they accuse you of, which I did do, I did spit on the officer and I did get in the fight. If a person is charged with something, the charge is the evidence. So being charged is the evidence. People don't like go to their 115 hearing, their write-up hearing, or their SHU hearing and expect, oh, yes, I have a fighting chance. I'm going to present, you know, my side of the argument and I'm going to be treated fairly. It's like, no, you're a dirtbag. You were charged. The charge is the evidence. Go away. Really, I mean, these are prison guards. These guys are paid to deal with, you know, people that they have a very low opinion of to begin with. So,
well, Stephen Cifra, I want to thank you for being with us in this first of a two-part conversation with you about your life and your experiences with the prison and what you're doing now. But before we close this part, I'd like to ask you about a eureka or an aha moment in your life that has given you a new perspective or changed your life.
Well, I think for me, the moment that turned things around, because I spent many years in prison and then I have since spent many years not in prison. And, you know, what changed, the big change came when I met a person who was a lot like me, but was no longer doing the destructive behaviors, the things I would do to go to prison. I saw this person living a life. He wasn't in prison. He wasn't controlled by the need to, you know, break the law or use drugs and things like that. And when I saw that, I realized I don't have to do those things. I don't have to get high. I don't have to, you know, basically behave in a way that's going to lead to my destruction, which I never knew before. I never knew that I had a choice.
Where were you when you saw this person?
Yeah, so I was at a party, actually. I was holding a beer, standing around a bonfire, telling this guy all about life and reality and things like that. And he was standing there. He didn't have a beer because he didn't drink anymore. And he told me, hey, you know what? You seem like a pretty intelligent guy. You seem like you have some potential and some possibilities. But, you know, nothing, you're never going to have a life if you don't stop using drugs. And or drinking, you know, same thing. And I didn't really hear him at that moment because I was drinking and pretty much under the influence. But what happened was I went back to prison. I got jumped by a couple guys, and I went back to prison. Actually, a guy and a girl, so a couple people. And I went back to prison for, you know, being in this fight, actually. As weird as that sounds, that's actually what happened. So yeah, I went back to prison and I thought about what he said about, you know, getting and using drugs and how that might be, you know, kind of at the bottom of what, you know, kind of the bottom of why I couldn't, you know, make things happen for myself.
How old were you when that occurred?
I was 29. So it was just before my 30th birthday.
And now you're 38 years old in 2013.
Yeah.
Well, Stephen Cifra, what would you like to do with the remainder of your one precious life?
Well, one thing that I've learned in the last 8 years is that that I'm actually a part of a community. I never had that sense before. The place where I come from, it's really dog-eat-dog. So, you know, being given an opportunity to go to school, being given an opportunity to have a life outside of prison, you know, I've really got this sense now that we're all in this together and that I have this unique opportunity to kind of give voice to a segment of the population that we're not hearing from. And so, you know, I'm gonna finish school, gonna get a PhD, and get a teaching position somewhere, and write a bunch of books, and you know, try to get this idea that there's two kinds of people in this world. There's the good people out here, and there's the bad people in there. I think that's made up. I think that's a fiction that is being used to promote a program, or even a pogrom, if you will. And, you know, there's more than meets the eye. And I want to spend my life telling people that, yeah, you know, if you ever had this idea that things aren't as they seem, you're right.
What I want to do is ask you to tell us that in part two,
okay,
the next edition of Radio Curious. And before we close part one, is there a book that you could recommend to our listeners?
Yeah, plenty. If I mean, just shooting from the hip, a really great book, an eye-opening book about the history of this country and where we're at today and where we're going. It's called The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander.
Stephen Cifra, thank you very much for being with us on part one of our two-part conversation with you.
Thank you, Barry.
Stephen Cifra is a 38-year-old undergraduate student at the University of California at Berkeley who spent, beginning at age 14, 16 years in prison. Almost half of that time was spent in solitary confinement. The book that Stephen Cifra recommends is The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness by Michelle Alexander. This interview was recorded on September 14th, 2013. Over 400 Radio Curious programs may be found on our website, radiocurious.org. They're free as my gift to you. I hope you enjoy them. Our address is 280 North Oak Street, Ukiah, U-K-I-A-H, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541, and email is curious@radiocurious.org. Christina Onnestad is our assistant producer. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.